Welcome to Today's Issues, offering a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Tim Wildman, President of the American Family Association.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the radio program, Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. I'm Tim Wildman with Ed Battagliano. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Tim.
And on Wednesdays, Abraham Hamilton III, also known as Abe, sits in with us. How you doing, Abe?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'd like you to start introducing me as Edward Michael Battagliano.
Are you?
Also known as Ed.
Okay. Edward Michael. But I never knew your middle name was Michael.
It is. My mom wanted to name me Michael after the, the angel, Archangel Michael.
I was just about to say that.
And many people think of me as an angel. But
your mom named you after an angel?
She wanted to name me Michael. My dad said, no, my name's Edward. He's going to be Edward.
Oh, okay. Your dad's name is Edward, so you're going to be little Ed.
Yeah. Okay. This conversation is going into danger.
So Edward Michael Battagliano also hosting with us today.
Also
thank you, Edward
Ed,
Michael,
the
for
angelic.
For being with us.
Can I say E. Michael?
Yeah.
E. Michael.
E. Michael. Edward Michael. It sounds like you're a lawyer for a firm.
Yes. E. Michael Battagliano. Yes. Get the money you may be entitled to.
Before you accept a check.
Have you had a fender bender? Sue the dog out of the person who hit you.
Don't let them get away with it. Huh? Take it out on them.
All right. A lot to talk about today on the program, as you would hope, on a talk show. That would be the case. We're going to talk about what's going on in Louisiana and parts of Southwest Mississippi, I guess, but most of the flooding that's taken place the last couple of weeks, that took place last couple of weeks, has been in south central Louisiana. And I read a column in our local newspaper on Monday. As folks know, we're based in Tupelo, Mississippi, and I was reading the Northeast Mississippi Daily Journal. And a good friend of mine, who's a sports writer, Parrish Alford, hails from that part of the country, and he wrote a column about having to not do his work as a sports writer covering Ole Miss at this time of year, getting ready for football season, and he had to be back home in Louisiana taking care of his family and seeing the devastation. And I asked Parrish to come in and talk. It was a very poignant but short column. How you doing, Parrish?
Tim, I'm fine, man. It's great to be back on American Family Radio.
Yeah, Parrish and I used to do a sports show together with
So Gene Mississippi, Phelps and Mississippi State and Ole Miss.
Yeah,
we all get along?
Yeah. It was just for
we could for an hour.
Just for our Mississippi stations,
it was
but
just
yeah,
for a show.
Yeah, but good to have you back on. I wish we didn't have to have you back on for this reason. Denham Springs, your hometown, is how far from Baton Rouge?
That's about, just across the river, the Amit River. So it's like Saltillo to Tupelo. Well, that doesn't help the national audience. So it's really about 5 miles.
5 miles. Now, tell us what happened and how. I'm talking about take us back to pre-flood. You're talking to your mom who lives there. What happened?
I woke up on a Saturday morning, and I started seeing my hometown on the Weather Channel, which is not a good sign. I got in touch with my mother. She's 78, lives alone, doesn't have a cell phone, so we're talking on the landline. She's getting nervous, and I say, well, tell me what you see. Well, I see water standing in the backyard. Well, okay, that's normal. That happens a lot. That'll go away shortly. Well, I see there's water in the ditch in the front yard. Well, okay, that's pretty normal.
Are you talking to her like every couple of hours?
This happened so quickly. This was over the course of one or two conversations. So initially, she's trying to describe things for me, and all things look normal. So our thought is, we'll stay there because we were in an area of the city that had never flooded.
Never?
So, never. Never. I worked through floods there in 77, 79, and 83. The 83 was then the historic flood, and it didn't get close to us. So I'm thinking, well, that water's going to go away because it always does. So you just need to stay there, and let's just ride this out. And that's what a lot of people were thinking at that time.
Now, how much rain fell And am I right to describe it as South Central Louisiana?
Yeah, it's not south. It's more South Central than anything else. Probably leans to the eastern side.
I'm talking about where the concentration of rain fell.
Yeah, South Central. And look, I hear the number 30 tossed around a lot, 30 inches over 2 days. It was like a system, and it wasn't a violent system. You know, it wasn't a lot of thunderstorms and things like that.
Okay, so you're talking, it's the rain just sat there
for 2 days.
It rained. 30. I remember, just to put this in perspective, and I'm no meteorologist. Well, I could be if I wanted to be, but I'm not.
Because it's not that hard.
Yeah,
right?
It's not. I mean, how hard can it be? It's going to rain today, people. Get your umbrella. No, I'm just kidding. The thing about it is, I remember one time, this is 25 years ago, it rained 10 inches in a weekend where we live. And they had to get my grandparents out of their home in a boat. And they lived, you shouldn't have to do that where they lived. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm trying to wrap my brain around 30 inches of rain in what, 48-hour period?
Yes.
So that's a torrential downpour 24 hours a day, not stopping, and that's what happened. And so anyway, go ahead with the story.
At what point did you realize your mom could be in trouble?
Well, as we got about an hour after that conversation, really, I started seeing some pictures posted on Facebook of that street and that area, and got back on the phone with her.
You're starting to get worried, aren't you?
Yeah, well, and by now, she's seeing water on the driveway and inching closer, and, you know, I'm trying to get her to call 911. Well, the phone goes out, and the call doesn't go through, so.
So you're in Tupelo. Mm-hmm. She's in Denham Springs. Mm-hmm. That's 5 hours apart. Mm-hmm. And you're talking to her on the phone. As you say, she has a landline. She's what age?
78.
78, lives by herself. Mm-hmm. What'd you do?
Well, I still have good friends down there. One is a sheriff's deputy. Another is retired law enforcement. And, you know, I was in contact with them. And
But I bet they're getting calls from other people, too.
Well, I understood the situation. I got her on a list to be evacuated. And really, before the deputies and those groups could arrive, it really was just neighbors with boats. And they knew that she was there. They knew to look for her. And she was evacuated by boat, not real far, a tenth of a mile or so, got on some dry ground and then was taken to a shelter. And then I was able to continue to track her from there and get her in touch with a family friend and into safe hands. So it was... there were about 6 or 7 hours there that were kind of sketchy. There were some times when I could not communicate, and that was difficult. But it played out, and she's safe.
Well, I mean, just the imagery that the rest of us saw was just incredible. I mean, it's like a Hollywood disaster movie when you see those kinds of images. So did you have other family down there, just your mom, or do you have...
You know, I have some extended family, some cousins who received water, and they're dealing with homes and trying to make decisions now. And you talk about these images, and, you know, I saw some of those pictures on social media, and I've heard media accounts and talk shows and just, news reports describe this as worst ever, worse than Katrina. I've heard all that, but you know, when you're there and you're just working on your house, I mean, I didn't see these images live. I didn't have time to get out and go look at what it looked like in the rest of the city. But what I saw in my small little part of the city were the same things that I saw in 77, 79, and 83. And those are people helping people, just getting debris to the street, getting your stuff out quickly, getting out your sheetrock and your belongings that you're not going to keep. You know, and you see these piles of debris, collect at the street, and ultimately the smell comes. You know, those are the things that I saw in my corner.
What about snakes?
I didn't see any snakes. I was fortunate for that. Every time I reached into a kitchen cabinet to pull out a crock pot or something like that, I'm thinking, is this the time? You know, is this when I'm not lucky? But I didn't see a snake on my property, thank goodness.
We're talking to Parrish Alford. Parrish is a personal friend of mine. He lives in Tupelo, Mississippi. He writes for the Northeast Mississippi Daily Journal, covers Ole Miss sports. But what we're talking about is he hails from Denham Springs, Louisiana, which is just not too far from Baton Rouge. It's kind of ground zero for the massive flooding that took place in the last week or so, couple 10 days or so. How long it's
August
been?
13th.
Okay. So Parrish wrote a column, Monday's paper, about having to back home in Louisiana taking care of his mom, and his home is severely damaged, like 60,000 other homes flooded.
Is it 60,000 now?
That's what I heard, 60,000 homes damaged by the flooding. And so he's talking to us about that. Abe, you grew up in New Orleans and went through Katrina flooding.
Yes.
Did that affect your home?
Yeah, the home that I practically grew up in was completely destroyed. We had 10 feet of water in our house. So I don't have any baby pictures.
You can't sleep there with 10 no. feet. Good night. No. Are you serious?
Yeah, no, I'm serious.
And that's why people drowned. There were, you know, bodies floating in the streets in New Orleans. 10 feet of water. People couldn't get away from it.
Yeah.
You
know?
Yeah, and New Orleans is below sea level. I don't know if people realize. It's 18 feet below sea level, and it's bordered by the Lake Pontchartrain and the Mississippi River, so it's a big bowl.
Yeah, I remember my wife, Allison, one time, we were down in New Orleans for a convention or something. She took a city tour, and while I was in a meeting, when we got back together, she said, I just went to a levee and looked down on rooftops.
Yeah.
And she said, if this place ever...
If it ever
causes a breach in the levee, it's going to flood the anyway, and that's what happened with Katrina. But back to what happened in New Orleans with Katrina, that was in a concentrated area, the flooding. What we're talking about here is this is not to detract at all from what happened on the Gulf Coast from Katrina, which was the Gulf Coast of Mississippi and New Orleans, but this may be even more widespread, the damage,
It's hard for me to track it like that,
right.
But when you talk about a concentrated area in New Orleans, I can tell you that when I drive to my mother's house and I drive from Mississippi to Denham Springs, I get off on Louisiana Highway 16. And some point along there, you can't see it, but you know the river's just over here. Not far from the road. Well, the places that received damage, I would pick that up on Highway 16, and I would guess 15 to 20 miles, 15 miles maybe, of where I know these areas got water and flooded. And it's not one river. There are several others. And, and like I said, that we're talking about high areas of the city that did not flood in the three others that I lived through. And what got my mother's house was a lot of flash flooding. When I saw pictures on social media of water already in her house and knew that she had probably 15 hours till the river crested, I thought she was going to have a situation like Abe described. I thought we were talking about the roof line. But because it was only about 3 feet.
I use the expression, this is not funny anymore. I don't mean it like humorous, but I mean, you're watching... You're keeping up with your senior citizen mom, 78, lives by herself.
Yes.
And she's talking about Parrish, water's coming up in our yard. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, you put her on the list to be evacuated, but how did you know she got, did she get evacuated?
Get evacuated. She was evacuated by boat. Turned out not to be with the sheriff's office list that I got her on, but just with good neighbors.
Yeah, so, but the landline, the landline's all she has, so you're kind of worried, what if the landline goes out?
And it did before the 911 call went through.
So you have no contact with your mom?
I did not, and she didn't make the call, and I didn't have contact, but I was able to make the contact.
So you're praying?
Yes. Yeah, there were some sketchy hours.
Yeah, you're talking about, Tim, the fact that, you're talking to an elderly parent.
Right.
Who, okay.
Just by herself.
You're just being paranoid. It's been this way before.
Don't
get scared.
Right.
And two, that changes at some point to the mentality, wait a second, this is getting scary.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, this is getting scary.
This isn't, oh, wow, this is kind of crazy.
Mom,
you might want to consider leaving. No, I can't leave. The street's flooded. Okay, the water continues to rise. Anyway, you I was serious about praying. You start praying, asking everybody else to pray. Now, what's happened subsequent to the your mom is okay. You go down there.
Right. Mom was okay. She got in the hands of family friends. I stayed there for a week. We were all together. She's doing as well as can be expected emotionally. She's not bad, and she is safe. The house, I had a lot of help last week with some people much more qualified than me. One who I'd never met just called me out of the blue, said, "Hey, I heard from my daughter who knows your son that you have this issue. What can I do?" People like that. So we were able to gut the house probably to the 80 or 90% level. Hope Reigns, you guys are familiar with that group.
Right, absolutely.
Has taken over, and I'm on a list with them. They have a key. I'm monitoring the situation with their volunteers.
That's Steve Tiber and 8 Days of Hope. Hope Reigns is a ministry of 8 Days of Hope. Wow. Have you heard the same figure, Abe? Have you heard the same figure? I have 60,000 homes and
yeah, if not more.
I've damaged.
Heard, yeah. Yeah, if not more. And
don't have flood insurance.
Yeah.
Most people don't.
It's an area that doesn't flood. That's not known to flood. So you wouldn't need normally to have to carry flood insurance.
No flood insurance for my mother or her neighbors. So just it's not there. It just wasn't gonna flood.
Let me just ask a question, because I've never thought about, you know, situations like that. You know, I've never thought about what happens if a volcano takes out my house. Mm-hmm. So what do people do if they've got no flood insurance and by tens of thousands? Do they just lose their homes? Does the federal government come in and help? But what happens?
Most people have applied for federal aid through FEMA. For our purposes, I'm waiting on a call. If I hear this phone ring right now, I'm not going to miss that call. You know, I'm just kind of waiting on that call, and it's supposed to come today, but we'll see.
You mean they'll help?
They will help. They will help. That's what we are told. That's what has been in news reports down there. We are expecting that some money will be available from FEMA for people who did not have flood insurance. But you know, I think most people are have signed up, are hopeful that that comes through, are happy that assistance is there, but are moving ahead with their plans.
Mm. Abe,
yeah, and That exactly is the process. You either prepare to rebuild your house on your own or avail yourself of whatever assistance is available to help rebuild the house. But this is something that has impacted such a large swath of the community there. You would hope that assistance will be available for those who don't have flood insurance. But if not, you know, you have to carry out your plans yourself.
I guess you hope the mortgage company or the bank helps you rebuild, and just, I guess, it's a second mortgage. I just have never thought about that. And
what if you what kind of damage does, let's say, how much water came into your mom's house?
38 inches.
Okay, so 3 feet of water. It sits there for a day. What kind of damage? Tell me the kind of practical damage that does to Does that mean you have to take all the sheetrock out?
For our purposes, we have taken out sheetrock to the 4 foot mark. Mm-hmm. So we left sheetrock above. Insulation will have to be replaced. Sheetrock will have to be replaced. I walked in and, you know, looked at a house that had not yet begun to smell, but would. Hardwood floors that had been installed just a few years prior had buckled and were going to have to come out quickly. And that was one of the first things we did. Carpet was going to have to come up, and we got that carpet out as well. And, you know, the water gets in the house and things shift and fall over. And, you know, things that you thought were protected because they were high, you end up losing because the piece of furniture they were on fell over and, you know, was submerged. You know, things like that. You know, that's not everything, but a lot of furniture moves and shifts and runs into this and that. And, you know, there are a lot of things
damaged. I guess all your electrical has, you have to be rewired.
Well,
and
you know, I think that's probably a good thing to do, but right now there is some drying equipment running in that house, and it's running on outlets that were below the water line that have dried out. And, you know, so it's.
Well, we're talking to Parrish Alford. Parrish is in studio with us. He is a writer, a sports writer for the Northeast Mississippi Daily Journal. Prompted this interview was, I was reading the paper, which is my local newspaper, on Monday. Parrish usually writes sports, and it covers Ole Miss. And I was reading where Parrish said, "Hey, I'm not doing my job the last few days because I my world is shrunk to my home in Louisiana where my elderly mom lives by herself and all the water damage you just described from the flooding. I thought this would be a good story for you to tell because it describes thousands of people in Louisiana right now. And I guess parts of southwest Mississippi, I don't know how much rain they got there, but I know that when I heard the figure 60,000 homes damaged or destroyed, I'm thinking, I've never heard of anything like that before. You're listening to the radio program Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. Ed and Abe here with me. And so 8 Days of Hope is doing, ironically, 8 Days of Hope, which is the ministry that we help support and promote, and Steve Tiber and those guys, they've been over in South Carolina while they were the same, very almost exactly the same thing happened in South Carolina, what, a year ago?
October.
Mm-hmm. October, where you had this freak storm system. I think it came off in the case of Louisiana, it came off the Gulf. In the case of South Carolina, it came off the Atlantic. It just sat there on top of Central Columbia for a few days and just same thing. So they had so 8 Days of Hope is over there with ministering to people and helping people remodel, rebuild in South Carolina when the floods happened in Louisiana. This happened 4 times. I know flooding's happened many times, but I'm just thinking these kind of freak weather systems. You remember it happened in Central Tennessee?
What? Nashville.
5, 6, 7 years ago or something like that, where it flooded the Opryland Hotel.
Right.
And it rained on them for like 4 days nonstop. Ooh. And so, you know, I guess unless you've experienced flooding in a massive area like we're talking about, it's hard to explain. Anyway, Paris, thanks for sharing with us. I would encourage people to go to, I know 8 Days of Hope is planning on, mm-hmm. you said going down.
Well,
they're already on the ground.
We're in contact with Hope Reigns,
which is
the subgroup.
Hope Reigns is the group. Yeah, excuse me for interrupting. Hope Reigns is the, I guess you could
rapid
say,
response.
Rapid response yes. team affiliated with 8 Days of Hope. You're right. So, go to 8daysofhope.com, 8daysofhope.com on the internet, folks. We encourage you to go there, and you can find out how to physically go and help or send money to help these folks in Louisiana as they go try to recover from this. So is the water all down now?
The water is down. The river's back in its banks, and you know, it's cleanup time.
Yeah. So what's Ole Miss's record going to be this year?
12-0.
There you go. He knows how to pander. Pander to the home crowd. Tell them what they want to hear, right?
Everybody's Parrish? Excited in August.
It's funny because Paris and I did the same thing Paris does now. Paris writes
pander.
I can pander if need be if the case arises. But Paris, you've been covering college sports for how long? 20 years now?
This is my 25th year as a beat writer in Mississippi.
Right, you covered
Meridian and Tupelo.
You covered Southern Miss, Mississippi State, and Ole Miss.
Right. I covered Brett Favre's last 2 years at Southern.
So, you being from Louisiana helps you be impartial.
Absolutely, people wouldn't believe that.
Yeah. All right.
You can't go 12-0. They have one certain team in purple and gold that they have to play. So,
yeah, Abe might. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, I'm a Notre Dame fan, so I've got no dog in this fight.
Yeah. Don't worry.
Thanks, Parrish. Parrish Alford, stopping by. To talk to us. We shall return momentarily with more of today's issues on the American Family Radio Network. Stay with us.
Next time on Today's Issues, we'll talk with Nabil Qureshi, author of Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus.
Well, as I was trying to disprove those things, I realized the evidence for Jesus' death, deity, and resurrection was very strong.
We'll also be joined in the studio by Maisie Pyburn to discuss the AFS Cultural Institute DVD, Reaching Muslims with the Gospel.
That's next time on Today's Issues, weekday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on AFR.
On the first day of our tour of Israel, we will stand on the Mount of Olives and look out over the old city of Jerusalem. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. March 9 through 17, we'll be going to Israel, the Holy Land. This is 2017, of course. We'll be flying from New York City, JFK Airport, direct to Tel Aviv, and then we'll begin our 9-day tour of Israel, including Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Jericho, Tiberias, Nazareth, the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and all the places you've read about since you were a child in the Bible. For more information on this tour, you can order a brochure by calling us at 800-FAMILIES, 800-FAMILIES, option 5. Also, you can visit the website twholyland.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and commentary next. There are reports the American Red Cross is banning prayer and Bible reading in Louisiana shelters.
Christian compassion wasn't welcome there in the manner that I had provided it.
Clay Higgins is a captain with the Lafayette City Marshals. He says a Red Cross supervisor told him to stop praying with flood victims inside a shelter.
He said the Red Cross is not a religious-based or Christian-based operation, and that they don't allow religious, you know, interaction with the residents.
Meanwhile, a pastor tells me four couples left a shelter in Springfield after they were told they could not pray or read from the Bible. Now, the Red Cross denies anyone's been banned from religious activity, but their denial is carefully worded. They say trained Red Cross workers can provide spiritual care. But what about regular folks? It sounds mighty suspicious to me, folks. I'm Todd Starnes.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to Today's Issues. That's the name of this program on the American Family Radio Network. We are, go to our website and check it out, American Family Radio, AFR.net, AFR.net. We live stream AFR there. And we also archive our shows. A lot of good stuff there at American Family Radio's website. We also have apps for your smartphone or other electronic devices like a laptop. Like a laptop or I guess an iPad, not a laptop, but an iPad or something where you can download the app, the application. Takes you about 60 seconds, and then you can listen to American Family Radio anywhere you go on your smartphone or your iPad or something of that. Clear as a bell on our app. So take advantage of that. That way you don't have to just depend on our over-the-air radio stations. We have thousands of people who listen to us on the apps. All right, I'm Tim with Abe and Ed, and we thank you, as always, for listening to this program. Abe, I wanted to, we got a guest coming up momentarily, but what do you make of this Clinton Foundation story that's in the news where the Associated Press broke a story late yesterday afternoon about the incredible number of overlays, if you will, or contacts between the State Department while Hillary Clinton was secretary and the Clinton Foundation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look good.
Nope.
At all.
Doesn't look good at all.
What's wrong? What's wrong with what appears to be?
Well, what you have is, and I use the analogy, it's as if Hillary Clinton put a for sale sign to the highest bidder on the lawn of the State Department that basically invites foreign entities, dignitaries, governments, whomever you may want to call them, to gain access to the highest echelon of American government for the right price.
Call it pay to play.
Pay to play, quid pro quo, whatever you want to call it. And what it does, it places our executive branch, our State Department, in the position of engaging in activities with foreign entities that literally puts our country at risk. Because, you know, under normal circumstances, you have the American government would take a particular stance on an issue or a person or a matter internationally or even domestically. But when you have this compromising with the pay to play, you have the playing field tilted, if you will, in favor of whoever paid the most money.
And so our foreign policy is what's supposed to direct our actions, not the fact that you're paying. Now, my understanding is there's no real way at this point to prove, because the Clinton administration, if it's talking about this at all, and I read another article this morning that says, listen, they're just not going to answer many questions about this. They're going to let it ride because there's only 75 days to the election. And Hillary Clinton herself, according to well-placed sources, just believes this is a non-issue and that people don't care about it. So they're not going to talk about it, mm-hmm. or not very much. They will in a debate if Trump brings it up or the questioners.
Go ahead, Ed.
Well, I was just going to say, but there's no real way to know if in these meetings there was what's called a quid pro quo, which is Latin for this for that.
Yeah.
You give me money, we'll do this mm-hmm. as, you know, part of our foreign policy. Because there's no witnesses.
Other than
Hillary Clinton. So what does a country do? Or her assistants. What does a country do when you weren't in there? So.
Let me simplify this real quick here. Because this was the Associated Press that broke this story. It wasn't a conservative news site only. but they did lay out several examples.
Mm-hmm.
What appears to have happened here by these examples, and the reason the Associated Press is reporting on it with the Clinton Foundation, you have a foundation is a nonprofit organization, all right? And so you have the Clinton Foundation over here, and Bill Clinton's and their family and friends, they're running it. Okay, they're raking in millions of dollars from around the world, including
$2 billion from the instance. Yeah.
Countries are making donations to them. Private citizens are making wealthy, powerful people from around the world, including Americans, are making donations to the Clinton Foundation, ostensibly to do charitable work, all right? But the foundation, as far as I've been able to tell, only 10% of the monies given to this foundation goes to the charitable work.
Mm-hmm.
The 90% goes for salaries,
mm-hmm.
for junkets,
mm-hmm.
for fancy hotels, mm-hmm. to have conferences at around the globe,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of this money too comes from countries that have terrible human rights mm-hmm. records.
That's right,
and that's why it's always been interesting to me how she claims to be an LGBT
right.
supporter while she's taking money from countries that throw gays off buildings.
Right.
Or give them lashes or put them into jail.
That's
so,
right.
But anyway, I digress. So you have this foundation over here, and then you have her at the Secretary of State. And so what the alleged violations would be that people gave money to this foundation over here to have access to the Secretary of State of the United States of America, Hillary Clinton, and her office, her department, could do favors
mm-hmm.
that benefit the donors to the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
And that's what, and that is completely, well, it would be illegal if you could prove it. But the appearance is awful. Even liberals are saying the appearance is awful.
Well, I knew something was up when I saw ABC News yesterday morning talking about this story, because usually they shut all these kinds of stories out. I will say this too, kudos to the Associated Press. Stories are now coming out that the State Department under Hillary Clinton stonewalled the Associated Press,
years.
Who were, for 3 years, they had to go to federal court
this is how
and
they work.
Sue them to release the information, the calendars, and so mm-hmm. on and so forth, so they could tie, okay, a donation was made to the Clinton Foundation on day X 2 weeks later, person Y was given access to the Secretary of State. So kudos to the Associated Press for bird-dogging this story.
Well, also, the other piece of evidence here, if that's what you want, if that's the way you want to put it, when you look at the circumstantial evidence in a case, mm-hmm. Abe knows this as an attorney, whether you can prove absolute. Anyway, the Clintons are worth hundreds of millions of dollars now.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Now.
Okay. They leave the White House, and Hillary Clinton says we were broke.
Right.
Here we are, what, 20 years later?
16.
Yeah, 16 years later, and she's only been in public service.
That's right.
And he's been getting a lot of money for speaking fees, but this Clinton Foundation has made them wealthy.
Now we know how they got their money.
Right.
So well, here's the thing about corruption.
Well, I say wealthy. No, it's made them filthy rich.
You may not be able to prove certain things, but it stinks. It smells dirty, and that's why these laws are in place to protect the integrity of government when you have people of questionable integrity in government.
And I'll tell you, Bill Clinton said the last day or two, if Hillary's elected president, he will get out of the Clinton Foundation,
mm-hmm. right?
Stop raising money for it. And somebody said, well, that begs the question: if Bill Clinton thinks it's an inappropriate thing to have his wife president while he's raising money from foreign people to have access to the White House,
right?
They give to you pay to play. You give to the Clinton Foundation. We'll do you favors.
Stay in the Lincoln bedroom.
Then, if that's inappropriate, why is it inappropriate while she's Secretary of State?
Yes, I mean, that's the question.
Huh?
Why is it inappropriate all of a sudden now?
Right.
And then here's the thing: are
millionaires
going to just go away?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know each other.
It looks awful. It looks like people were paying to have access to the Secretary of State or in her office to do them favors. And even liberals have said this. But, you know, Mrs. Clinton has reached a certain threshold of untrustworthiness and dishonesty with the American people that I don't know how many more scandals you can pile on where it matters anymore.
Right.
Because they've already baked that into their decision. They've said, I don't – So what if she's for sale? I'm still voting for her.
She's a liberal.
Right.
So
it's
her policies I'm interested in.
So I don't know. Maybe it'll move the needle some in favor of Mr. Trump, but I don't know. And I doubt any investigation by the FBI should be done, an independent investigation of what we just described. If it were Republicans, certainly it would be. But with the Clintons, we've seen they just have a way of getting away with stuff that other people can't. It's uncanny. All right, you're listening to the program Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. I say getting away with stuff. I guess her supporters would say she's done nothing wrong.
Right.
Okay.
And they do.
I did not have sex with that woman. Remember that? All right. So. You want to just save that for Friday.
Save that.
Okay.
In my imitation.
All right, you want to changing subjects?
Subjects. Yeah. I want to welcome Ed Shaw, who's pastor of Emmanuel City Center in Bristol, England. He's author of the book Same-Sex Attraction and the Church, The Surprising Plausibility of the Celibate Life. Ed, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you.
Now, Ed, and you have three co-hosts today, Tim, I'm Ed, and Abe, so we'll try not to confuse you. You can ignore the names and just respond to the disembodied voices. This book is a little controversial for a lot of evangelical Christians. Now, just to kind of set the stage here, you are same-sex attracted, okay?
Yep.
All right, and you have written a book trying to help Christians because you lay out the problem for the evangelical church, I think, brilliantly, and that is that so many people see either people struggling with same-sex attraction or fine with it, completely okay with it, and it looks like the evangelical church is saying, well, The only way for a person who wrestles with same-sex attraction to go to heaven as a Christian is to be celibate, and that's not fair. Have I kind of laid out, kind of flesh out the problem facing the evangelical community in the West?
Yeah, I think loads of people think that to ask anybody to be single for whatever reason is just an unreasonable thing to do, when actually it isn't. Jesus demonstrates that it's not an unreasonable thing to do in his single life, and the Apostle Paul calls singleness a great gift, and a gift that he thinks is better than marriage in some ways.
Well, so here's the part I think is going to be controversial for some of our listeners, okay? You appear to be saying that there are some people who will struggle with same-sex attraction all their life, and God can't change that. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that's what people are going to come away with. And that is a very big conversation that is going on in the church right now. Have I kind of laid that out accurately? Help us, walk us through what you're saying.
I think God can do all things with him, you know, all things are possible. So I wouldn't want to say it's impossible for God to take my own same-sex attraction away. But I want to point out that he doesn't necessarily promise to this side of the new creation where everything that's not good about me would be taken away. So I just want people to think themselves into the situation where there will be some people who have experienced this same-sex attraction taken away, who grow out of it, who find it's just a phase. Sexuality is quite fluid. The secular world recognizes that. But there will be some people for whom it's an experience to their dying day, as there will be many Christians that struggle with lying until their dying day, or who struggle with lust until their dying day. God promises to take and use those things to make us more and more like Jesus, but God doesn't necessarily promise to take away any pattern of our sin in our lives. He can, but he doesn't promise to.
So you would liken same-sex attraction to, you're saying it's something that is a result of our fallen nature, and that people can be Christians and yet recognize in their lives that this is a struggle against a fallen impulse.
Yeah, as we recognize the same, with heterosexual brothers and sisters in Christ who struggle with lust, or people, to use example, who struggle with lying. But I also want to say that the experience of being same-sex attracted, a lot of it's wrong and very negative and bad for me and bad for others. But some of the experience has been taken and used by God to do good in my life and for others. And so to say that the whole experience of being same-sex attracted is totally wrong would also be unhelpful for people like me as well, because there are good things that come out of it. And I think in my personal experience, another thing to talk about in the book is how God's taken and used my experience of same-sex attraction to do me good, to help me see my need for Jesus, to help me become more and more like him, and to help other people see their need of Jesus and become more and more like him too. So I wouldn't want to see my experience of same-sex attraction, my sexuality, as a totally negative thing. It's something that God has taken and used to make me and others more like Jesus.
Hey, Pastor Shaw, this is Abe here. In the materials, there's a statement here that says, "I've kept discovering the main reason brothers and sisters in Christ are abandoning Orthodox teaching on sexuality is not because of biblical exegesis, but because of what they perceive to be the unreasonableness of what same-sex attracted Christians like me are asked to do." What do you mean by that?
Well, I think people see sex as human right, and that to be fully human, you have to have sex, and therefore to deny somebody like me sex is to deny me my human rights. That's how the narrative that the world around us sort of goes, and people find it very hard to respond to that. And if people have made sex such a big thing, to deny anybody it is seen as terrible. Sex is a big thing. It is a good thing. It's one of God's good gifts in creation, but it isn't everything. And it's possible to live human life, to thrive as a human being without sex. And obviously Jesus is the best example of that. But the most perfect example of humanity that this world has ever seen was lived and died a virgin. And we've got to recover that and help people to see that you can live life, you can experience genuine and real intimacy without ever being in a sexual relationship.
What's the name?
Return people to that.
Pastor Ed, this is Tim. What's the name of your book, and who's it for, basically?
Well, the name of the book is Same-Sex Attraction in the Church, The Surprising Plausibility of the Celibate Life, and it's really for every Christian. It's obviously, you know, written with other Christians who experience same-sex attraction in mind, but it's really written for the whole church, because if we get to help brothers and sisters who experience same-sex attraction like me, stay loyal to the Bible's teaching, stay loyal to what Jesus says, we've got to help them. And this book is really seeking to sort of say, let's wake up to their needs and let's see how we can be church and church family in a way that helps same-sex attracted brothers and sisters, but which will also help loads of other people in our churches too.
You know, I have friends who have been, you know, I'm 57 years old, who have been single their whole lives. They're heterosexual. They wanted to get married at some point and just haven't for whatever reason. And scripturally, the church, the scripture, God calls them to live a celibate life. Mm. And what you're saying is that the world says, well, that's unfair. You know, they should be allowed to go to singles bars and have sex because that's part of being human. So how do you, and this is part of what your book tries to do, how do you, and how does the church more broadly, take the message to people and say, you know what, fellowshipping with Christ far outweighs in glory and joy and peace any other experience we can have as human beings. We're surrounded in a culture that promotes sex as probably the highest good. How do we communicate that to not only the new generation coming up, but people who struggle with just being single?
I think it's to recover the real purpose and I think fundamental meaning of sex in the first place, which I think is to point us to where the world is heading, which is a marriage between Jesus and his church, and Jesus and his church becoming one, and Jesus and his church enjoying the most intimate, united relationship of all for all of eternity. I think sex within marriage is just a trailer for where the world is heading, and you know, all of us will get to experience the eternal bliss of a united relationship with God's Son, Jesus. Sex in creation at the moment is just a little picture, a trailer for that. You know, come to new heavens and new earth, I'm not going to be kicking myself that I didn't have sex in this present, you know, earth, because I'm going to be experiencing an intimate relationship which far surpasses anything that's been experienced by anybody in the here and now.
Ed, by the way, what's your church? Where do you serve?
I serve a church called Emmanuel City Centre. We're 2 years old. We're a church plant in the Anglican Church in the beautiful city of Bristol, which is well worth a visit.
But by the way, Ed, I just meant to point this out as I was typing in the name of your church, Emmanuel City Centre. It's spelled C-E-N-T-R-E. That's a misspell. You know it's supposed to be C-E-N-T-E-R, right?
there's so many things that are lost in translation over the pond.
You're not talking Bristol to Tennessee here.
That's right.
Bristol, England.
We're talking about the original Bristol.
Yeah, the original Bristol. Okay, I got you. Well, thank you, Pastor Ed, for being on with us. And
my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, my friend. Appreciate it very much. Take care.
Same-sex attraction and the church.
What do you think about that?
I have more questions.
Yeah. Oh, did you really? Oh,
No. Yeah. Just not for him necessarily, but just go ahead. The interview provokes more questions.
That's why I gave our listeners a heads up. It's kind of controversial because it makes it seem as if you're saying God made someone gay, and of course that is not true. But when you're dealing with the flesh and the fallen nature, it can seem as if this is exactly the way I am. I've written a couple articles on this, by the way, in the AFA Journal, and I may have blogged on it one time several months ago. But this is a really tough subject, and the problem is, Abe, a lot of Christians I know they don't even know really what he just said in terms of what sex is actually meant to point to.
Yeah.
The knowledge of Christians is very shallow, so it's hard to begin to. Well, as he said, it's to point to the relationship that God desires to have with his people. You know, that's what Paul says in Ephesians 5.
That kind of intimacy, you mean?
Yeah, well, the husband and wife are meant to mirror the relationship of Christ and his church.
What he's saying is, he's saying, I have a sexual attraction to men, right?
That's yes. what he said.
As part of my being.
That's what he said.
Right? Okay.
And then while
and
God...
I have to deal with that through celibacy. I have to reject those feelings so that I don't sin against God.
Right.
Right. And he said in the same way somebody might have an inclination to be a liar.
They might struggle with lust. They're like a man might
struggle. Or a heterosexual man might struggle
with lust all his life.
Okay. He's putting that in the same. Okay. So, Abe, you seem to resist that notion.
I think, and I know this is a controversial issue, he alluded to the secular world embracing the concept that sexuality is fluid.
Yeah.
I think there may be an underlying either assumption or presumption that attraction is fixed at birth, which is a controversial topic.
Right.
I do think one of the things that is good is to show that that the pinnacle of human existence is not physical intimacy.
Right.
You know, to point to an eternal hope, but you know,
You know, the hope to me. We're all born with sin nature.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it matter what your sin is? Because your sin could change tomorrow or the next day or the next day. So we're all born with is there really any sin difference between committing an act of sodomy, homosexual behavior,
right,
and adultery? That is having sex with somebody that's not your wife when you're married, or any other kind of sexist really?
Well, I think his book is written for two purposes. It's written, first of all, to give Christians who think it's a very easy thing to change who you're attracted to give them a view into the struggle, and it's also a way maybe to help the church help those people come to wholeness in Christ. I would say this. Part of the problem, and I don't know how you change this because language in some ways is set in stone in our culture, I technically don't believe there is such a thing as homosexuality. Once you say, well, there's heterosexuality and homosexuality, you've already divided the human race into two different sexual orientations. Mm-hmm. I think there is simply the male-female model and heterosexuality, and people who are homosexuals have a broken human sexuality. At some point in their lives, they were supposed to, you know, a young man was supposed to become attracted to young women, and it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we need, as Christians, to try to figure out why that didn't happen, but there isn't really any such thing as homosexuality. There's heterosexuals with broken sexuality, and that can be manifested in I can't be a one woman man. Mm-hmm. I just have to have sex with as many women as possible. That's just the way I'm made, or pedophiles, or all sorts of manifestations of broken human sexuality. So the very fact that we say heterosexual, homosexual is already unbiblical in my view.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Romans 1 describes homosexuality.
Well, it uses the English word for it, but the activity...
It's unnatural.
It's the activity that the New Testament talks about.
Right.
You cannot... A man cannot lie with a man as he would with a woman. So the English word is brought into it, and I think that simply has confused the issue.
But now, I've had conversations with people who are alcoholics, and I'll say to them, why don't you just quit drinking? And they'll look at me like, why don't you just shut up? Because you have no idea what I'm going through eternally. You know what I'm saying? So I'm saying in the same way, people who have compulsions to do things that are sinful, we can't excuse it, but you got to understand it's more than just, why don't you just stop sometimes?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Okay, we'll be back in 5 minutes with more of today's issues.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.